Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's episode is brought to you by our friends over at Beat Dratty. Obviously, Beat Dratty's been a big sponsor of the show for a long time, one of our earliest sponsors. They have a new product line, the Beat Dratty Sport. So they've really taken their time developing this line. It's not your typical tech fabric. They, you know, kind of scoured the earth for the best fibers, and they have, you know, not only polos, which they had last year, but they also now have the Blair pullover. They have many, many different sport lines. I highly recommend these as we get kind of towards the summer months, and they're good for other activities too. I mean, you could play tennis in these things. You could go for a jog. You can mow the lawn in them. Like, you don't have to worry about, you know, getting sweaty and ruining, you know, your favorite polo. Like, these are built for that. So definitely check out the sport line at beatdratty.com. If you use the promo code FRIEDEGG25, you'll get 25% off your order. So check out the sport line at beatdratty.com, and thanks for the support. Today's episode is with golf course architect Scott Sherman. Scott has had a long career in golf architecture that has seen him work for a number of different architects, including Pete Dye, Bobby Weed, and now, most recently, he is partnered with the Loves, Davis and Mark Love. And one of the recent projects that he has finished is the Ocean Course. He worked with the resort and worked with the team with Jeff Stone and the maintenance team at the Ocean Course to add some new tees, tweak some existing tees for this PGA Championship, as well as move some trees around and kind of get some design features back on that golf course that had gone away. So we talked with Scott a lot about the Ocean Course, as well as the opening of Belmont Golf Course in Richmond, Virginia. Belmont is a A.W. Tillinghast Donald Ross course that has been converted into a first tee facility with their, you know, restoring 12 of the original holes out there, as well as building a 6-hole short course and a large driving range on the 18-hole facility. So we talk about that project and the work that went into that. So without further ado, we've got the PGA Championship coming up next week. This is a talk with Scott that should get you a little primed about the golf course.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
What was the first time you saw Kewa Island?
Well, the first time I saw it would have been in 1989. We went there as a family, my wife and I and her family, partly because it was under construction. And I'll never forget, my father-in-law and I tried to, and I had just been married several months before, we tried to ride our bikes down a sand road, the now entry road, all the way down to the golf course, and it was so soft we gave up, and we decided, well, we'll go out on the beach because we know the sand is hard. And so we found our way to the beach and then rode up until we saw construction, and we came into the golf course at what is now 14 green roughly. Mm-hmm. And doggone, it was like the surface of the moon, to be honest. Just at that stage, it was just all sand everywhere. Hurricane, I'm trying to think, Hugo had probably not hit yet.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. That by the timeline, that would probably be before Hugo.
That's right, because it was later in the year, and we went during the summer, I'm fairly certain. And so that was my first introduction there. And Pete was not there. Alice was thereabouts somewhere. But I met several of the guys that that were working there. And that's an ironic story too, because I ended up working with those guys elsewhere in the future dates, not too long after that. And they got me in touch with Miss Alice, who she and Pete were living there in a condo somewhere. And I still have the letter that she sent back to me. We actually sent letters back and forth in those days. Mm-hmm. And she suggested a way for me to, you know, work for the Dye family and turn me on to Perry Dye, who was in Denver. And anyway, that was sort of the start of me getting to know Miss Alice, and then eventually Perry and Pete and PB and Roy Dye, Perry's brother, et cetera. And so that led to a job with the Dye family starting in 1990.
Is that how you got into golf architecture?
Yes and no. It's sort of an interesting story. My dad was a friend of a golf architect here in Greenville, actually, who worked for George Cobb. I knew at some point that I wanted to be in the golf business. I played high school golf with a guy named Chris Patton, who won the U.S. Amateur.
Oh, yeah.
And the first time I saw him hit a golf ball, he was in the eighth grade, I think. I said to myself, you know, I'm not going to be playing golf and feed myself. So I got to think of something else. And so through high school, I really didn't have that feel. I didn't know exactly what was going to happen, but I had always drawn golf holes. Even as a child in church, I drew golf holes on the offering envelopes. And so it was something that was in my brain. And slowly but surely, as I got to college, and I sort of worked it out in my head, hey, this is something I might want to do. And I attended my first Masters tournament in 1986, the Saturday, and saw Jack Nicklaus and saw Augusta National for the first time. And it just sort of crystallized for me what I wanted to do. I wasn't sure how to go about it. But John LaFoy, a longtime friend of mine, and a guy named Tom Marzoff, who works for Tom Fazio, they both lived here. And they sort of patted me on the head and said, here's what you should do. And so I did a few things to sort of prepare myself. And I'll never forget, my wife and I went to the Tour Championship at Harbortown. And I had never been at Harbortown. And we walked the golf course. And after the 14th hole, there used to be a pot bunker left of that green that was just mean. There was a ladder. I said to myself, I need to go meet Pete Dye somehow. And found him eventually, and found Miss Alice at the Ocean Course. So it's sort of a circle of life thing. Just one thing sort of led to another.
Mm-hmm. So you've been working with the Loves, Love Design Group. And,
yes.
You also are doing, you did the, you know, renovation work with new tees and some restoration work at the Ocean Course in prep for this tournament. Obviously, you know, you saw the Ocean Course at its earliest stages. How would you say that the course has evolved since, you know, the early days to what it is today?
Well, my goodness. So we're 30 years from construction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Pete said it best. And needless to say, Pete is the architect, the brains behind it. You know, Pete was not well when I helped do some work there with the team at Kiowa, big team of folks. But with Pete's absence, I just sort of had to keep the team together and help them out. But the Kiowa folks were great. But as Pete would say, you know, that golf course walks or moves more than any other. So one of the things we did was looked at a number of old slides. They were actually slides, and we had a slide projector. And we would look at the slides in the office of Stephen Youngner, who is the head professional, and sort of look back during some construction photographs and also during the Ryder Cup, and just try to get, again, a feel for the place. And it has changed so much. You know, it was a very difficult golf course for the Ryder Cup, as Pete was tasked to do, build the toughest golf course you can think of. And there was just a lot of native, a lot of sand, a lot of things to avoid. And, you know, once that tournament went through, there was a need for the resort to get players around. And I'm not exactly sure when this occurred, maybe after the current owner bought the resort or bought the golf courses. But some widening took place, all the while still a difficult golf course, hosting World Cups and senior PGAs and obviously the PGA back in 2012. So what we tried to do was, obviously, we had to deal with some length. Kerry Hegg said, hey, we've got several golf holes, and I have a list here, that need to remain long par fours depending on the wind conditions. So we went back to 520 plus on some of these long par fours. So that's an evolution. And we tried to put back some of the sandy, duny areas. We chunked in. There were so many dune plants that, you know, Pete had planted 30 years ago that had taken over, sea oats, et cetera. So we tried to expose some sand and bring it a little bit more in play here, there, and yonder. There were a few I would call blowout bunkers originally. And so we were able to put some of those back. I mean, they had been there. They were just grown over, and we exposed these blowout bunkers. I can think of hole number 7 and a couple others. And they'd lost some trees over time. So we actually moved some very large oak trees into several golf holes from other golf holes, Rory's tree being one of those. The tree in the middle of three fairway is a, quote, new tree from 2019, and it came from the sixth hole, and it's better than ever. I'll diverge a little bit. I always said since that tree got placed, I wish Pete could have seen it because it really fits well and looks better than ever. And so we just tried to restore aspects of it. Now, Carrie's focus to some degree was getting gallery around and shifting some gallery so that we could use some of the back tees that we weren't able or that they weren't able to use back in the 12 PGA. So we did some flip-flopping and going backwards and building some dunes and putting some tees on them, sort of like hole number 6 is quite a far back tee. It's quite elevated now, and you can see the ocean and the clubhouse from there. And there's other examples of that. So, again, just trying to expose some of the natives, some of the sand, move some natives around, restore some bunkers that were not available to us anymore visually and strategically. And then we did some changes, for example, to number 7, some slight changes that were a little bit more in keeping with Pete's changes to holes like 9 and 18 over the years. And as you know, Pete tinkers, and he tinkered with that golf course over the years in preparation for major events. So we tried to, he's our architect. We're doing what he would want, I believe. And Roger Warren and the whole team was right there every step of the way. And we put it all back as best we could. And I'm just part of that team.
Mm-hmm. How will 7 play differently with the changes?
Well, you know, one of the things that Pete did is, let's say on number 18, I would call them nooks and hooks that he put, let's say, in the big bunker left of the green. So we just added some nooks and hooks that sort of reflected that look. It's a little bit more penal. You know, if you try to cut that corner, it's a left to right tee shot for that par 5. And if you cut that corner, you might be in some of the nooks and hooks, which was one of his evolutions, something he added to golf courses a little bit later in his career. So you got to be careful. And of course, if you blow it left, that's not the strategic side. And if you hit it too far left, you may be in a couple of our new blowout bunkers that are sort of long and left. So wind will drive everything. It will dictate everything there. And for Mr. Goodwin's sake, we're praying for a little bit of wind because it will make for a much more interesting event, which we think will happen in May.
Yeah, I mean, I can't have much less wind than it had in that August date in 2012. It obviously blew, and it was a crazy Friday. But outside of that, it was pretty tame, and right. And rain, also softened the course. And this year, leading in, it's been almost a drought down there. So we right. should see a lot different playing conditions, at least, even if we get a little bit of rain. With regards to the ocean course, one of the things that I think that stands out at the ocean course is the shaping and the work that was done. You know, it's a very artistic look. It obviously is not like your naturalistic look of minimalism right. that's in vogue today, but at the same time, it doesn't at all look manufactured. When you're out, working on somebody else's golf course, how do you try and mimic that shaping, and what stands out about the ocean course's shaping to you?
So some of the discussions I had with Pete and Alice over the years, which were certainly nowhere near as many conversations as some folks, because I didn't work with Pete dozens of times. I was fortunate to work with him maybe 8 times or so. But I felt like I had a working knowledge and had seen so many of his golf courses and studied so many and worked on so many. I've sort of seen the evolution a little bit and talked to him a little bit about the strategic evolution of his golf courses. So the shaping aspect of it there was based on Miss Alice's idea to make sure you could see the ocean from every golf hole, tees, fairways, greens. And so the elevation of the golf course is very noticeable. They had lots of sand to work with. And the steep and deep edges that are, you know, that Pete's known for, but yet not repetitive, and not just perfect anything, were something that, you know, I just tried to emulate. And he was one of the ones that said, you know, we're trying to create a third dimension, height, width and depth, you know, so it's not just a mound. It's got some dimension to it and some character to it. And don't finish anything too perfect because, you know, nature's not going to be perfect. And even though it's a constructed environment, let's make it look like it's been eroded a little bit and not just perfect, perfect.
That's an interesting, you know, thought of, you know, not trying to make it, you know, I imagine in many cases you get in the field and everybody's trying, you know, those to make it look perfect. But the idea of not making it look perfect because, you know, nothing in nature is really perfect is one that kind of sticks out as a good thought.
But correct. And we all the time coach our guys. And I've been fortunate to work with only a few golf course builders over the years, and they perform really well. And we've always tried to coach the guys and remind the guys and the new guys, don't rake this too much. Let's not, you know, I run a little bit of equipment and I'm not great at it, but that's a benefit because I could never get anything perfect. So it's always imperfect as I run a little bit of equipment, especially a bulldozer. I have great respect for the guys that run bulldozers all day because I am not wanting to sit in a seat. I want to be moving all the time. So we remind them to not be perfect. And if they want to see something that's really imperfect, throw me on a bulldozer and it'll be a mess, but that's imperfection. And we try to plan that in and tell the guys, do not rake, do not finish, do not box blade things too much. We just don't want it so perfect.
Mm-hmm. That's like the famous Alistair McKenzie quote, you know, if you want an interesting green, hire the biggest fool in town and tell him to make it flat.
Right. and you know, Pete, I think had a comment, and I can't remember the name he used, but suffice it to say, people would ask, well, you know, Pinehurst number two, whose greens are those? And he would say, well, Joe Smith. And what do you mean, Joe Smith? We thought that was Don Ross. Well, you know, Joe was on the rake and the shovel and he was part of the crew. And, you know, Ross gave him an idea and he just went with it. So much of what we do, I try to encourage, because, again, I've learned it from Pete and Bobby Weed. I try to encourage these guys to interject their ideas and their thoughts so that we don't do something that's just repetitive.
And given that era and, you know, his contemporaries, like Tom Fazio, Robert Trent Jones, it seemed like, you know, Pete Dye had a, you know, a distinctly different management style. Talk to us a little bit about how working with Pete and what that was like, you know, in the field.
Well, it was interesting. And, you know, it was his quote that said during some hard economic times, you know, if I needed to pare down my staff, I'd have to get a divorce because it was just he and Alice. And that's a model that a lot of us that have worked with the Dye family or connected with them in one way or another carry to this day. You know, we just were kind of free agents. And you've talked to lots of these guys that, you know, sometimes work with Bill and Ben, or sometimes work with Gil Hands, or, you know, just kind of in and out. But, you know, the times that I worked with Pete, you know, he was high energy. Even the last project I helped him with, which was in North Florida, he would have been about almost 90. And even at that age, as his health was starting to decline a little bit, he was pretty active in his mind and had new ideas. It was hard to keep up, you know, physically. He walked very fast and was throwing out ideas. And, you know, I learned long ago from Bill Coor to have a notebook with me everywhere I went. I do that to this day, and, you know, just took notes and so forth. But you know, you just never knew what was going to come out. And for any of us to say we're trying to think like Pete thought, that's not possible. So you just never knew what was going to come out. And so you look at Harbortown in 1969, or you look at Whistling Straits many years later, and they could not be more different looking. But strategically, you can see Pete's thoughts and his ideas about strategy and the way he moved players around with these S holes, making the player work the ball in two directions. So he was always thinking about each golf shot, make sure that if it was left to right the first shot, the second shot needs to be right to left, making sure par threes were all in a different direction, making sure there was balance on the golf course so not one particular type of player could take advantage of a golf course because of his particular strength. And I think you've seen how his golf courses hold up to this day.
Yeah, I think that's the thing is like you often see Pete Dye characterized as one style, but you know, if you've seen a large body of his work, there are so many different styles, even back to before he made a trip to the British Isles. You know, those right. first like 10 to 12 golf courses he built, like Radrick Hills is one that sticks out to me, is so much different than what he built, you mm-hmm. know, in late in life, like Whistling Straits.
Right. Or the golf club in Ohio. That's mm-hmm. quite different. I'm fortunate to be working on Delray Dunes in Boynton Beach, Florida. That was their first golf course in Florida. And quite different. So, yes, you're right. He was influenced by his trips to Scotland and whatnot. And some of that became his sort of stamp and signature. But even after that, they all ebbed and flowed and changed and were site specific. So that was a gift that he doesn't know he gave me. And Bobby Weed doesn't know he gave me, but the ability to just think differently and try to pull out something about the site that can be unique is a gift.
Hey, one of the courses that you've worked with the Loves is the Plantation course at Sea mm-hmm. Island, where they mm-hmm. obviously host every year as the second course for the RSM. I'm interested, you know, what have you taken away about the professional game from that project?
Well, so when it comes to that particular project, you know, we were confined for space. There's only so much you could do as far as lengthening the golf course. And again, it is a resort golf course. So trying to balance those two things is always foremost in our mind. Mm-hmm. But we've really, and we're all fans of having the players, particularly the good players, challenged at the green. And if we can challenge them at the green, that's really where we can make them think. And so we thought a lot about challenging these guys at the green.
Mm-hmm. How specifically do you challenge players at the green, where it remains more playable for the resort guest?
Well, so, and again, I would go back to some of Pete's thoughts. Fairway cut around greens, and it's sort of a strange thing to think about this, but I very much believe that shortcut is easier for the bad player, but harder for the good player. And why I say that is the bad player just wants to get something up on the green somehow. The good player is going to sit there with multiple clubs and say, "Hey, what's my option here?" And once you get them thinking, and Pete used to do a lot of that with intimidating water or something. But once you get them thinking, you sort of got them a little bit because they have so many options. A bad player can just put it up there and they're all good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the ocean course would be a good example of challenging around the greens, where obviously it's tough everywhere with the wind, especially when the wind blows. But with those greens built up, you know, all the good players, the professionals are going to have to worry about missing short, long, right, left, and the ball getting mm-hmm. further away from them because most of the greens are perched up with shaved edges.
And then green shapes. I mean, one of the things Pete was great at is not only contour, but the actual shape of the green so that you could tuck a hole location. You could bring the hole out to a more open spot. Miss Alice always wanted the front of the green as open as possible, depending on the length of the hole. And so that's good for the resort player, the average player. But you could sort of tuck hole locations here and there behind something, a bunker or a bulkhead or something, and challenge the good player that way. So we very much built a golf course at the Plantation course that was, and our goal right up front was to somewhat emulate the older style of Rainer and McDonald, Banks a little bit, and Pete, and sort of mesh those together, because Pete was a Seth Rainer fan and would say that very openly.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the neat things too, you know, just in terms of shapes, but, you know, with when you're talking about Pete, is always a look at the orientation and the angles that that these unique shapes sit on, and how those, you know, if you just go to, you know, a Google Earth and Google a, you know, Pete Dye course, and you just look at the way they orient, they're so varied across the board. And in like what you talked about earlier with thinking about each shot, I think that's one of the things that stands out with the way Pete built golf courses is the orientation in the greens and how that dictated everything back to the tee.
Absolutely. And he was very keen on left to right, right to left to right, right, you know, all, over and over again. And he sort of, without knowing it, would reveal some of his thoughts about how a green should sit, and, you know, what aspect of the green should be closer to the player and what aspect should be hidden from the player and that sort of thing. And so it, you know, from an early age, early 20s, it started to get me thinking strategically rather than just the mechanics of building a golf course. Although Pete was, he told me from the beginning, get your rear end in a ditch. You need to learn how to build a golf course from the ground up, which is what I did. Our first project in Hawaii, I was very much in the dirt and continue to be. I mean, we've learned to be golf course builders and designers and all of that together. But so much of his thoughts were just in me, and people like Bobby Weed and other folks that have worked with Pete way more than I have that strategic thought at all times. It's not just a landscape feature. It's not just a construction project. We're thinking strategically with every shot.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything, you know, from the Plantation course, and obviously you'll get to see your work here at Kiowa in a week. But is there anything that happened at the Plantation course that you maybe took away from watching the pros play that, you know, you carried to Kiowa, or you'll carry to a future thing, like, you know, I thought this might work, or this worked way better than I imagined? Is there anything that, you know, any revelation that's come over the last few years of watching that tournament be played?
A little bit. And again, my concern is we're losing the distance battle. The equipment, all equipment is so good. And you know, what do you do about length? And so that's why Harbortown, or to some degree, a little bit lesser degree, but to some degree, the Plantation course is good to challenge the tour pros, because there are certain places they really can't just hit driver and swing as hard as they can. We're okay with these guys not hitting 10 or 12 drivers, every round. And again, Harbortown is a perfect example of that. It was just at the tournament there, and they visited there quite a bit and learned a lot. Every time I've been watching these professionals and how they navigate that golf course. So yeah, just going back and going back and going back. I mean, we just don't have enough property to do that. Now the Ocean course, because of the wind and because we have the property, you know, they will never set it up as all the way back on every tee, because that's not appropriate.
Yeah, I think one of the things you made a point about not getting too fast. I think one of the things that you lose when greens get really fast is, like, you lose the advantage of being able to reward aggressive, you know, putting, you know, and when you have to play defense on every putt, you know, that's not, you know, you're worried about an uphill putt rolling 3.5 feet by, like, that's not, you know, necessarily rewarding the person that put themselves in the position where they can be aggressive, you know? And I think that's something. And then also you reduce the amount of places that you can put a pin.
Correct. And over time, we're reducing the contour we can put in a green. And one of the things that is neat about the Ocean course, and I've spent a lot of time over the last few years with George Fry, who was the original superintendent and helped Pete build the Ocean course. And because those greens are pospalum, there's an opportunity for us to keep Pete's contours, because the pospalum won't get too fast, and we're at a seaside location, and so they'll not be crazy fast, and so some of these more contoured greens are okay there, and it's refreshing. Now, they probably will be 12 at the fastest, which for you and I is probably pretty quick.
Yeah.
But for these professionals coming off of Augusta National and other places where the speeds are probably higher than that, it's a neat difference. And as long as the wind is there but not crazy, it will have an influence. And so that's one of the things that Mark and Davis and I talk a lot about, is let's put slope and contour back in the greens. And we've done that for some years now, even for tour events like the one at the plantation. Let's put some contour back in the greens, and let's maybe slow them a little bit so that we add to the difficulty for the great player right at the greens, because they're just going to hit it as far as they want to. But let's make them think, and thinking is hard work.
So what are you, with the PGA a week away, what are you most looking forward to at the tournament and with the course specifically?
I spoke with the folks down there just the other day, and the place looks great. George said he thought it was presented as well as ever. Jeff Stone is the superintendent there. So obviously there's aspects of the competition. There's aspects of how the golf course looks. What we were thinking, you know, for example, we were able to add length and move back the tee on 18 so that they can use that back tee. Previously, they couldn't use the back tee because of the grandstands and whatnot. So we got it out of the way, and hopefully it will challenge the players more than it did before, and they will have some longer clubs coming into that green. We deepened some bunkers, which is just natural. You know, in that setting, sand blows, and the bunkers sort of rise up. Some get shallower, some get deeper. So just every aspect, to be honest with you, I'm looking forward to seeing and getting the reaction from the owner and, you know, hosting. And it will be interesting to see a lightly attended event. And I don't say that in a bad way or a good way. It's just there'll be less folks there, as the PGA of America has announced.
I think that the reality is, obviously, revenue wise, it's not a good thing for the PGA, but
right.
for spectator viewing, if you're on site, it's better. And then also, if you're watching on TV, you get to see more of the golf course. Like, I think that was one of the big revelations people had last year when there were no fans, is how much more of the golf course you got to see without all the infrastructure. And there'll
That's
be
right.
substantially less infrastructure. So you get to see more of the long views out of the ocean course. If you were going to pick out, you know, for our audience, one hole in particular that you think is going to be compelling to watch, you know, when the telecast goes and now over to X hole, you know, what's a hole that people should maybe perk up and make sure they watch a little bit of golf on?
Well, I would always say 17, and I've been asked that question before, especially if it's windy. Now, we were able to, one of the things we did is replace just about all the bulkheads and bridges and so forth there. And as part of replacing the bulkhead on 17, and Pete had changed that green some years ago a little bit, we were able to get the green closer to the bulkhead and whatnot. So we'll see where they put the hole location, but I would say it's 17. You know, it's right there by the ocean. It obviously is sitting on the water, and it's near the end of the day. It's near the end of the tournament, so it's pretty compelling. As you might remember in the Ryder Cup, it was very compelling in those days, and hopefully, you know, there'll be just enough wind that there'll be a substantial club hit into that green, which today might be a 5-iron. I would just love to see somebody hitting 5-iron or more amongst the leaders in the event.
Yeah, especially if you get the right wind. Having been out there so much, you know, can you talk a little bit about the variability of the wind out there? Obviously, a lot of people don't get to spend, you know, a lot of days at Kiawa. You know, most people can't afford it, but, you know, like, having spent a lot of time out there, is the wind as variable as people say it is?
Well, I would say sure, especially if fronts come through and whatnot, and I would think May would be a little more active front-wise. You know, when you're there in the summer, it seems like it's kind of calm and hot and humid in the morning. And then as things warm up a little bit, the breezes get going, the ocean breezes, and you know, I'm not as familiar with the prevailing wind, but you know, the prevailing wind may or may not matter, because at the moment you're hitting the golf shot, where is the wind coming from? Because it can swirl, it can die, it can rise. And it's all about the moment.
One of the things that I think that's cool about there out there about the wind, and this goes back to, you know, Pete's design, is just how, you know, you play in the same direction, right, for so many stretches out there because of the long, narrow nature of the site. You know, you play out and you play back and then you play back in. But how different each shot moves with the wind. You're playing in the same direction, but you know, you might be having a 4 o'clock wind and then a, you know, a 2 o'clock wind, and mm-hmm. you know, how it just tweaks all the time, and you never seemingly can get settled.
Mm-hmm. And that's absolutely correct. And most of the unsettled nature is because of what Pete has put in front of you, regardless of what the wind is. And that's partly why, you know, he does this figure eight routing quite often. If you look throughout his career, the figure eight routing is very well known amongst the golf courses he's done, to put hazards on one side of the golf hole for several holes, and then you flip over and the hazard on the other side. And I can think of PGA West, I can think of Teeth of the Dog, and you just go on and on, this sort of somewhat figure eight routing that gives you that different wind and gives you that different angle all the time. And he, with his hand, has added additional angles and additional unsettled things that are going on in your brain to try to overcome what this next shot looks like, even if you're in the middle of the fairway.
Mm-hmm. So to move subjects on, you guys are just wrapping up a restoration and then a redesign, in the sense of you're going to a short course at Belmont Golf Club, which is mm-hmm. a old A.W. Tillinghast. It was later worked on by Donald Ross, public municipal facility in Henrico County, Virginia, which is just outside of Richmond. It was the site of the only major championship ever held in Virginia, and it was won by a Virginian, Sam Snead. Right. Obviously a huge municipal win for municipal golf, in the sense of, you know, it was a golf course that was very much, you know, in peril. They were looking at alternative options, and the first tee there was obviously a big part of getting the ball rolling. Tell us a little bit about that project and working at Belmont.
Well, it was just a very, very rewarding project. They were in the early stages of submitting their proposal and teamed up with us, with Love Golf Design, and said, hey, before we go too far, what do you think about this idea? It was 18 holes only. That was all there was, 18 holes in a clubhouse. No driving range. There was one putting green, as I recall, but that was it. They said, we want to take those 18 holes and create 12 full-scale holes, 6 short course holes, a putting course, lots of practice area, and a driving range, because our programs, the first tee, and they have now 3 facilities, our programs need those kinds of facilities. We think the city needs various options to bring people into the game, fast playing options, or somebody can stay here all day long and have their fill of all the golf they want. And we immediately said, absolutely. With all that we're doing in regards to short courses and alternate facilities, and all that the world is seeing now over the last 10 or so years with these alternative kind of routings and short courses, et cetera, we absolutely think that would be the right thing to do. No qualms about it whatsoever. So we teamed up with them. Their group was selected, and it all went fairly quickly. We were under construction in the midst of COVID on May the 4th of last year, and it will open May the 24th of this year. And it's just one of the most enjoyable projects, except for some weather issues. But we had to get creative, and we studied what we could about the old Tillinghast and some of Ross's changes. And we tried to hone in on an era for a Tillinghast, and ironically, Wingfoot was the host of the U.S. Open last year. So that was somewhat of an influence. And as you know, Davis won there, and Mark has played there a lot. He and Mark have played there quite a bit. And we had some greens that were really interesting and just put them back, just rebuilt them and put them back, and tried to infuse a more parkland style look to the golf course, removed a bunch of trees. But we were very keen about creating these alternate facilities. So we wiped out several golf holes to create a new driving range, which is going to be fantastic for anybody, but particularly the first tee programs. We did take a couple of golf holes and convert them into a 6-hole short course, which we took inspiration from some of Tillinghast's, I guess you would say, more famous or more notable par threes out there. They're not exact copies, but like the Reef Hole and Tiny Tim. And we have sort of our version of the Dual Hole from San Francisco Golf Club, and tried to be faithful to what we saw on the big course, where bunker locations were, and like I said, the greens and so forth. And so Mark is actually there as we speak, and we'll be back in 2 weeks for the opening. And it was just the greatest thing ever that we've been involved in, and it will serve that community well. I've said this many times, we've all said this, I wish that facility was in my backyard. It's on 100 acres. It does everything we need golf to do today and for the future. It's not the end all be all for the club folks, and meaning country club folks and big daily feed facilities and that sort of thing, but it is the perfect complement to bring people into the game and keep people interested in the game.
Yeah, you know, I've got mixed emotions about. Obviously, I'm a history nut. I would have loved to see the 18 holes of the original 18 somehow restored, but obviously, you know, it all comes down to clients and they wanted range and it makes sense for the first tee. It's just a new iteration of the place, and it's cool to hear that you tied in a lot of the historic, you know, giving it that sense of place. You know, I highly recommend people going. It's so convenient. I mean, it's right on off of I-95. It's in Richmond. It's a great place to visit because you've got that big town. You've got, you know, things to do, but also you can get out and play a quick round of golf if you're there for whatever it may be. We've seen a lot of you know, former tour pros get into the golf design business. Mm-hmm. You know, and obviously there's been a mixed bag of results. How involved is Davis with the business? And you know, what's unique about his view on golf courses? And you know, maybe some of his personal preference across, you know, the country, world, and tour, you know?
And it's interesting because, yes, Davis is involved and he has a passion, and that passion just is growing. So as it is with all of us, it seems like if you have a passion for something, it just grows over time. The other thing that's interesting is, you know, he's obviously the most accomplished player in the group. Mark is great as well, and I can just maybe keep up. But Davis is the most concerned about the average player. He's
played a lot of pro-ams.
That's correct. And we have all grown up doing something in the golf business, all of us, from the shop to maintenance to design to construction to, you know, we have a varied background, but it's all aspects of golf. And he knows the business well, as do the rest of us. So he's concerned about the customer, whoever that is. There's only, whatever it is, 2,000 players in the world that can play at the very highest level. And then all the rest of us want to have fun. And so he's always concerned about that. So, you know, it's funny because we're always sort of pushing the envelope a little bit, and he's sort of reining us in a little bit. But it's a very collaborative thing. And I think the best golf courses are built somewhat in collaboration. No golf course is built by itself or by one person anyway, because of all that it takes to build a golf course. But when it comes to making decisions, collaborations are great. You don't want the committee to be too big, but it seems like the three of us mesh really well. Mark and Davis are very different as brothers. And of course, I'm a brother from another mother, I guess, to some degree. So, you know, we all have our various perspectives, and it seems to work well. But yeah, Davis seems to love it. He loves playing on equipment, and he can run a bulldozer better than any of us. That he's the one worried about the average player more than the rest of us. And his mom. If his mom can play it, then everybody will be good.
I feel like that's such a good way to think about stuff is, you know, especially if you're with good players and they don't understand what you're talking about with playability is like, hey, you know, if I put your grandpa or grandma here, would they be able to hit this shot? Like, what, you know, imagine hitting this shot, you know, with a 3-wood and they'd be like, oh yeah, that'd be hard. It's like, yeah, well, that's you know, you got to think about this stuff.
Oh, yes. And you know, that jogged my memory about something. So you mentioned the plantation course. One of the things we did there, of course, they have lots of practice and now we have a putting course there and they have lots of options at Sea Island. We added a 6th tee. Some folks call it a family tee, but it's a little under 4,000 yards. And one of our clients called us after played that golf course. He at the time was probably 78 and then his wife was as well. And he said, hey, we played the plantation course for the first time and my wife had the greatest time. And here's what she said. She said, hey, Bill, you guys get to move up a tee as you age from the back tees and you just keep moving forward. And us ladies, we have a forward tee and that's it. Well, these guys have built a new tee for me. And she played this 3,950 yard tee and had the greatest time ever. She was so happy. And if mama's happy, that makes everybody happy. So it was one of those things that we have done on golf courses, but got very tangible feedback from someone that owns golf, that knows golf, that loves golf. And, you know, he said, we're going to put those on every one of our golf courses if we don't already have them. And so that's something that at Belmont, for example, is a great addition, you know, and we learned just from that scenario that the super seniors, not just the kids, but the super seniors love that forward tee. They can keep playing golf until they're 100 from that forward tee.
I think good players should go play the forward tee.
Try to shoot 59.
Yeah, exactly. Teach yourself how to go super deep. And it's right. You'll find it's really hard because then you get yourself all these weird 40-yard pitches. And it's a great practice. Yeah. Like, that's some of the best practice is going up to the very forward tee and trying to shoot as low as you can. Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're excited to see Belmont when I could get out there and excited to see more of your guys' work. You know,
well,
I think
you.
The plantation course, I haven't been, but it looks really interesting. And, you know, hopefully a great PGA championship at Kiawa. And you're on Instagram. People can find you at Scott with 1 T Sherman. Easy handle to find and keep you updated on all the places you're working at.
Well, thank you so much, Andy. And I'm just so, as I said, I was so thrilled to work there at the Ocean Course and somewhat circle my professional life in a complete circle in some way, and just humbled by the opportunity. I told Roger Warren when he called me, I was almost in tears. I just could not believe, never expected such a phone call. So we're thrilled to go. I'm going with some family members and we'll just take it all in as best I can and savor the moment.
Hopefully it's the you're just doing the first 8 of the figure 8. So you're not done with the circle.
Right.
You've got a whole other circle coming.
We'll see. Yes, we'll see. And I appreciate that optimism.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you much. Good to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's episode was edited by Meg Atkins and Garrett Morrison. A quick reminder, be sure to check out our events. We've got events across the country. We are sold out on a bunch of them, but we still have a few spots at Rolling Green in Philadelphia, a great William Flynn design, as well as Davenport. And that's just outside Chicago. It's right on the Illinois-Iowa border. And that is one of the best Allison golf courses in the country. So check out our events. You can find them on thefriedegg.com. There's a tab for events. Go there. You'll find information about all of them. And we hope to see you out at events this year in 2021. Thanks for listening, and talk to you soon. Thank you.